You're listening to Artifact Chat, curated intersections of America's past and present. This is episode 3, Interrogating the Scammed American Domestic. Hey everyone, Lindsay Griffin here. Welcome to Artifact Chat. If this is your first time, thanks for listening. Artifact Chat is produced monthly for your enjoyment. Show notes, links, and other great stuff can be found at artifactchat.com. Today is going to be a mashup of satire, heritage, Scandinavia, and the American Midwest. And here to guide us through it is Christopher Merkner, author of The Rise and Fall of the Scammed American Domestic, a collection of short stories which won the Colorado Book Award in 2015. His stories have appeared in Best American Mystery Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories Anthologies, as well as numerous journals. He currently teaches creative writing at Westchester University and the Lighthouse Writers Workshop. Christopher, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Lindsay. Very happy to be here.
So we're going to talk about your short story collection today, and I've actually just finished reading it for the second time.
Brave.
I know.
That's great.
I know.
Thank you.
You have described the collection as warm-hearted satires that explore the relationship between place and language, a playful and hopefully enjoyable representation of the way we use and talk about heritage in the contemporary American Midwest. Others have categorized it as Midwestern fabulism, calling you the Grant Wood of short fiction and a masterful voice of modern satire. The collection is the site where ties of family and the community intersect darkly with suburban American life. And though humorous, I found these tales to be dark. In one, a man's inability to communicate with his daughter results in years of silence. In another, a son stabs his mother in the heart over dinner. A wife plans to invite her ex-lovers to a party and enlists her husband's assistance. A couple's desire to paint their home turns into obsession. Christopher, would you start us off by talking a bit about the unifying vision for this collection? What are the pieces that hold it together?
I think most of the stories, if not all of the stories, have characters that are coming from a place that I'm pretty familiar with, which is a place of community in the Midwest that hasn't seen or felt or experienced a great deal beyond the Midwest necessarily. And while now at 41, I perhaps have seen or done more, I think the characters that are in that particular book are probably a closer approximation to my experience in my 20s and before, even earlier or younger. And so even though I have characters who are middle-aged males primarily, they are all operating from a sort of juvenile and youthful innocence. They don't know how to respond to complex realities in a way that is the most progressive or thoughtful or considered. You feel sympathy and pity for them. At the same time, you sort of celebrate their innocence and you sort of almost laugh at the insanity of their lives.
It's interesting to think about applying the innocence and perceptions of one in his 20s to middle-aged characters, especially because so many of the conflicts facing the male characters you describe occur in domestic situations. The book is called The Rise and Fall of the Scammed American Domestic. Could you talk too about the Scandinavian or Scammed American and its influence on your work?
The other piece of this is the Scandinavian communities that I grew up, my church and my church communities. My dad is a Lutheran pastor. I would say there's a certain element that was important to shaping a perspective. Also, suffering was to be expected. Something was to be good. One had to endure hardship, which came too easily, was tend to be suspicious or something to be doubted or questioned.
Though the stories are satirical and employ exaggeration and other elements to poke fun at and examine, there's also a certain tenderness toward the characters that you've expressed, even describing them now. Could you describe the qualities expressed in this book, or maybe about the Midwest, or even your upbringing, that this book looks at and sort of celebrates in a way?
If you're asking me, and I think you are, what are the qualities at the core of this book that I really value and cherish the most, is the fact that they continue to stay together and they work through it. And I guess that's true of the less broad representations of family and even the specific ones of husbands and wives. And despite the rifts and the crises that should surely divide them, they remain steadfast in trying to make it work. And I guess I really value that a great deal. I don't even know if it's healthy that I value that, to be honest with you. And intellectually, it seems insane, to be honest. But emotionally, there's something I really value about it. Yeah.
That's really interesting. This is maybe also along those lines. In other interviews, you've talked about writing as a means of interrogating and exposing the things that you love. You said the only critiques worth writing are the ones about people and circumstances you respect. Could you elaborate a little bit on the purpose of critique and then the relationship between the subject and the one interrogating it and how that plays into this book?
I've tried to write about things, objects of study, to critique them, to better understand them, to interrogate them, that aren't important or meaningful to me or aren't connected to me somehow or that aren't my experience. I can't say that those have been terribly successful because I guess I just feel largely that it's an unethical enterprise to begin appropriating the experience of other people. Anytime I've tried to write about a single person or I've tried to write about a person in another country or something other than Northern Europe, it just tends to fall really flat and feel kind of empty overall. There's so many things to interrogate, and I guess I just don't feel terribly well equipped to interrogate them all. Again, what matters to me is what I feel like I can account for emotionally and intellectually, not just read about in the newspaper or something. But I would just hasten to say I'm not proud of that, and I don't love that about myself. I'm pretty impressed with the way in which writers can really write about things that are not quite so centrally located in the center of their personal experience. I admire that a great deal. I just don't know if it feels like the right thing for me.
Since we're talking about interrogation and your relationship with the subject you're interrogating or criticizing or even looking at, could you talk a bit about what you view to be the purpose of satire? Are you initiating a conversation with the reader? Are you deconstructing? Are you disorienting? What do you want these satires to accomplish?
Mm-hmm. For most of the work, I guess, in this collection are first-person narratives because I guess it sounds so often like the way in which I think, and I think in a lot of ways the stories are ways of sort of recognizing the way in which I think or view the world or view a relationship or view a family, and the realization that this perception or this reading of a circumstance or reading of a person or an articulation of a person is so flawed, so wrong in so many ways, so misinformed. For all the privilege, it seems so underinformed. And it's absurd, ultimately, to see the world in the way that one who's privileged is afforded to see the world. And I guess that's tends to be, I don't know if that's so much like a choice that I made deliberately when I set out to start writing the first of these stories or something, but rather something that sort of just became clear. What happens in the stories is, you know, equally frustrating or outrageous, but it's usually their perception that matters more to me, and usually the object of the satire.
It's interesting to think of the satirist as the subject. Yeah. You are the starting point for the subject of your satires.
Yeah.
Although I'll say when I read this, though it is set in the Midwest and though it is spoken through people who have connections to the Midwest, it feels like a very American book in terms of the perspectives. I'm also from the Midwest, so mm-hmm. I might be a little bit skewed in terms of like what I think an American right. perspective is. So it's a little bit
or
dangerous
very American.
To say that. But I'm grown in the Midwest, but I've lived other places and I felt like a lot of these attitudes, a lot of these things are sort of in the family, relationships between husband and wives, men specifically and their children, though parents and their children, seem to me to be things that are not just existing in the Midwest, but sort of more broadly.
Yeah.
And so then I was kind of thinking about this sort of blurring between heritage and place and then also kind of country in the book. So it's interesting to think about how you start in such a small place, you know, with yourself and then moves out to sort of...
I hope so. I think you're a writer. You hope that what you're articulating, the smallest version of it, has larger ramifications or represents a larger reality or larger experience than just what you were targeting or even what you were sort of exploring. I mean, so yes, that's very nice of you to say. Thank you.
One thing for me when I was reading this, and I'll say when I started, the place that I first felt like I had gotten disoriented and then reoriented was in Tom Tom's.
Yeah.
And so I thought maybe we could read an excerpt from that and then maybe talk about it a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Outstanding. Thank you. Tompton's. When no customers stopped for a massage, and most did not, the father called his son over. If he protested, the boy was seized and dragged and made to put his face into the chair's padded pillow. He held his breath while his father practiced his techniques on him. The father's techniques were brutal. The man had no training. He had no touch. And he seemed to know this. He often asked for his son's feedback. "Stop crying," his father would whisper into his ear, "and tell me how the hell to do this." The one time the boy told him, "Maybe use more palm," his father thanked him sharply. The boy was then chopped across the spine in one fantastic blow. Those who were purchasing their groceries at the front of the store heard this. They turned to look at the minister and the boy, face down in the massage chair. The father smiled at them. He waved. Tepotement, he explained. Just the tepotement technique, very big in China. The boy would not offer his feedback again. He stopped speaking to his father. He could be found in the massage chair for 6 or 7 hours a day, listening to his father comment on the lives of people from his church, yet never speaking a word. The father pressed and stroked and pummeled and pinched his son's body. He could feel it give beneath his hands. Whenever the boy's body tried to grow, the father could feel it. So well had he come to know the boy's body, and he pressed and pinched those developments away. As a result, the boy stopped growing. He began indeed to shrink. By the age of 16, the boy was as big as he'd been at 4 years old. He required a booster chair for the massage chair. Those who walked past the two of them over the years became concerned. They asked the father sometimes if he had more than one son. The father only laughed and nodded vaguely, but they were moved. It would have been difficult to ignore. The once large boy was now a helpless little imp. It was clear to everyone what the minister was doing, so they began asking for and offering money for massages, and when they pulled the little boy out of his father's massage chair, they handed him to another person who took the tiny child away to be fed. They slipped the boy food right from their grocery store bags, just out of sight of the minister. The boy ate frozen fish sticks, chocolate cereal, fruits and vegetables, candy, eggs, tea bags, entire loaves of bread, bags of cornmeal, anything at all that they showed him, anything he could grab from their bags. They laughed about it. They were pleased. They did not mind his gluttony. They watched as he snapped up anything he could find. The only thing that stopped him was a can of foie gras.
Thank you. I was kind of curious if you could talk about the origins of the story. How did it develop? What did it start as? Maybe we'll start there.
There was a call for the fairy tale review for fairy tales relating to children. And so I thought, well, I've never written one, and I thought I would try it. That's where it started. So I tried to write a fairy tale. I don't know that it was successful. I mean, they accepted it. That was a mercy, but I'm not sure in terms of the world of fairy tales if it's terribly successful. But the story came from that impulse, was to write for this little contest that came out. And then I have on my shelves many books related to Scandinavian culture. So, I mean, there are all these sort of strange little kitschy books about what it means to live in the Swedish way. And I mean, I think they're trying to be earnest. I think a lot of them came out in the 70s, but I just find them very fun and very funny to think about being Swedish in that way or being Scandinavian in some way. Anyway, one of the books I have on there is not so much serious, but it's literature. It's the Selma Lagerlöf's The Wonderful Adventures of Nils. It's a story of a boy who rides on the back of a goose. It's a number of stories. I think they're relatively popular still, although I can't say that I knew them or grew up with them or anything. They're Swedish stories, and they're translated. And so it's this sort of series of stories about Nils, who flies on the back of a goose and enjoys the natural world. I was just sort of sewing the narrative of that together with the story that I was creating about massage. I guess I was perplexed by the number of massage places in the front of grocery stores, primarily like a Whole Foods or something. And people who are comfortable enough to get a massage in this way strikes me as just so strange. But then the person who would sort of capitalize on it and sort of, I mean, it's their business. And I think they think of it as like a service they're providing for humanity. And I imagine they are. I just can't relate to it at all. So to watch that in the grocery store line, I think that was feeding into this. Anyways, sort of a fusion of these sort of things. I was sewing them all together, I think, was the attempt anyway.
It's interesting to hear about the origins of the story, specifically that it's rooted in fairy tale. Because for me, this story echoes what you said earlier about the core values of the book. I know you were talking about family, but here it's the community which comes together despite a kind of dysfunction. And it's their benevolence that sort of rescues the son from his father and later enables the son to handle his father more gently than his father has handled him. And when I read that the first time, it was very striking to me. It seemed very different than some of the other stories in the book. And I think because it is in some way kind of this celebration of the community, you know, rather than being destroyed or caught up in a pattern of violence, the son is able to take his father's place and sort of offers something to the community and offers compassion to his father. So can I ask you to read one other excerpt?
Yeah,
and it's back there. So this one is The Last Cottage, which is the last story in the book. And I picked this one to read next to Tom Tom's because there is also this communal element, and actually the narrative voice is kind of this communal narrative voice. And so I'm going to ask you some questions about that, but I'll let you read it first.
Okay, cool. We know the Larsons. They come to Slocum Lake each summer. We would like them to stop, but they do not stop. For 15 years, they have come to Slocum Lake to stay at their place on the waterfront. They own the only remaining cottage on the lake. They possess the only waterfront property that has not been commercially developed. Here in Slocum Lake, we could use that development. We desperately wish they would sell. Instead, they bring their children and teach them the ways of traditional summertime Slocum Lake living. It's very depressing, it's very outmoded, and our tolerance is pressed. In June, someone paid to have someone electrocute Slocum Lake to stun and then kill some of the fish. It wasn't terribly expensive. A collection was taken. The more expensive part of the process involved gathering the dead fish and corralling them into the part of the lake that runs about 20 yards out from the Larson's beachfront and approximately 50 yards across. The expensive part, actually, was installing the concealed netted cage that kept the dead fish where we wanted them, mysteriously pent up against the Larson's beach. The Larson's always arrived on one of the first days of July. They rolled in at nighttime. We presume they are sheepish people. It is possible their drive down from the north of Wisconsin is longer than we know it to be, because perhaps their children make them stop frequently. We don't exactly know. We know they arrive late at night, as a general annual rule. We know they carry their children into the cottage, put them in their respective bunk beds, knock off the bedroom lights, lock up, and walk down to the beachfront. This year, they arrived this way again. When they walked down to the beachfront, they held hands. Their hot truck engine was still ticking in the gravel drive. Locusts were scorching the ears of the trees of their property, the only native trees remaining on the waterfront, the inglorious poplars. Summer had come very early to Slocum Lake. The locusts had hatched early, too. The nights were very warm and still. The Larsons exchanged a few inaudible remarks. Their shoulders were rubbing. Once they reached the waterfront, they turned to face one another, held one another, and then they kissed. They kissed for quite some time. They have kissed before in previous years. They usually stop kissing and go into the water together. This year, they did not go into the water, but instead they only made docile, unremarkable love, gathered their clothes, and ran naked back toward the cottage. They were laughing. When they stepped onto the porch, they stopped laughing and were very quiet as they slipped in through their screen door. They never turned on any house lights. They simply vanished into the dark of their little dwarfish cottage that everyone on Slocum Lake wanted to blow up. We would not want to hurt the Larsons. The Larsons are good people with good intentions. They leave their home in the northernmost Wisconsin and head south, just as everyone in Illinois not affiliated with Slocum Lake and its general population, or in its general and perpetual state of impoverishment, goes north to summer on the largely virgin beach water up there. No doubt the Larsons know exactly what it feels like to have strange people perching on your property, behaving as though it were their own just because they purchased it from you. We actually feel for the Larsons as people. We feel for them enough, in any case, that we try not to be awkward about our determination to oust them. We believe confronting them would be awkward, and in the end, because it would likely change nothing, needless. Instead, we have for years determined to be chilly and unwelcoming. We believe this would be enough. Then they had the children, and we could see the future we imagined, fiscal and otherwise, being denied us.
Thank you. So maybe start by talking a little bit about the origin of that voice and kind of how it was developed.
I had written the story a fair time before this story became The Last Cottage, and it was the same dynamic of people from northern Wisconsin coming down to Illinois, because one of the more interesting trends in the part of the Illinois that I lived in, everyone had a cottage in northern Wisconsin, and so they would all go in the summer to summer for a week or a month, and they would often invite our family to go up there, and it was always a great time. But I was thinking more about how strange that was over the years, and so I was thinking of inverting that dynamic of having someone who would otherwise be living in northern Wisconsin move back down to Illinois, or to come down to Illinois to summer. And so I was trying that story in a number of different ways. And then one night, I just started with a different voice. I mean, it wasn't even intentional. So I was just playing with it on a computer. Then I just shifted the voice to the first person plural. And then everything just sort of fell into place, and it became increasingly absurd and increasingly sad, and everything changed. I mean, other than the dynamic of this family coming down to live on a lake in northern Illinois, everything really changed, and it just became this sort of telling of a story of a family and what these people will be willing to do to get rid of that family.
I know you're not supposed to read the end of stories, but I thought we could read like the last paragraph maybe.
Okay.
And then it wouldn't give away what happens, but it would sort of give away where we were going.
Okay. They shouted. They screamed in ways we could not have predicted. They ran to the water. They shielded their eyes from the sun and searching. Robert waded in several steps, and then he turned around to look at Penny. His face, we could see, was rent. He yelled to the skies above us, for states around. He entered and left our chests. We know the Larsons, yes. We have known them for years. Now we know they know loss. Now we know they know us.
Thank you. Yeah. One thing that really struck me is how passive-aggressive the community is in this story. And I think that that's something true in other stories in the book, where the main character, here the community, finds himself in conflict. And rather than confronting it, they seek to sort of undermine the person or people with whom they are in conflict. I'm thinking about the wife who, after she has a child, wants to invite all of her lovers over, and the husband arranges it and then sabotages it. Mm-hmm. We have them to raise us. That's what it is. Yeah. I was thinking about that, where there's this attempt to totally undermine and destroy. Mm-hmm. In that instance, especially, maybe what the wife is wanting is something that is not necessarily worthy of support. But we could argue about that. Yeah. But I just thought that that was kind of an interesting line throughout.
Yeah.
Was that intentional, or is that something that I'm picking up on?
I mean, I think that that's definitely part of my upbringing. I think it's definitely part of something that I'm interested in thinking about, is unease around other people's existences and then the discomfort that people feel with other people's choices and the discomfort that people feel with other people generally. And yeah, this sort of desire, often unwitting, almost instinctual desire to somehow deprive them of that in its fullness. And it's not entirely clear why, because I don't even know that it's entirely clear why did those people, jealousy, misunderstanding. I'm not really exactly sure the cause. I mean, of course, there's a range of causes or reasons, but that's the whole thing. I guess a lot of these characters aren't bad people on the whole either, but the things that they do are often highly questionable. Or in the stories, I think, I mean, it's fiction, right? So, I mean, I've exaggerated, I pushed it, or I tried to push it. I thought that was fun. But I suppose one doesn't typically go that far.
No, I guess when I was reading, part of the orienting for me, I think, was the story where the mother asks the son to stab her in the chest.
Yeah.
You always hear, "You've stabbed me in the heart," or whatever. Right. And I thought, these are enactments of things that we say, or that we just taken to this level beyond what people in general actually do. Although, you know, but I don't want to say, but so that's sort of how I perceive that everything is heightened, so as to capture our attention, to shock us, to cause us to think about that. I know for me, I can reflect, when have I wanted, and maybe not even understood why, as you say, for something not to go well for someone else, and what's at the root of that?
Yes.
And I think that that's probably, maybe just me, but I'm guessing probably something many of us can relate to.
Absolutely. Well, you're right. Again, I think what we were talking about earlier, I think it definitely probably comes mostly from my own sudden striking awareness of my own choices. I mean, much like you're just confessing now, is this sort of realization that, like, at the core of most of these stories are impulses that I myself have had. The extent to which I'm willing to go to deprive somebody of something, and the way in which I justify those choices as well.
I thought it was funny to start with this crazy idea of putting a bunch of fish in the front lawn.
Yeah.
That hilarious, and it gets much darker, but some of the other stories begin in a much more violent place, and violence, not that there isn't violence enacted in that story in some ways, but it's more below the surface. There's this kind of physical manifestation of violence, and then there's this interior that sort of can become physical, right?
Yes.
And then nobody is exempt from being susceptible to that, right?
Right. I think that's a big part. Thank you for that. I mean, I think that that's a big, I think the violence of language is particularly sharp because, again, generally speaking, most people don't literally act out a lot of their impulses or act on impulse or do the things that they wish they could do or have the right means to somehow process through what they're feeling. They resort to fairly sharpened, brutalizing language that is what I, at least in my experience, is pretty normalized. And again, it's only now in sort of retrospect, looking back, that I realize just how normalized that sort of language can be, and how the translation of violent language into violent act, I think, is an interesting one.
Yeah. I think in this story, the Larson family is a barrier to the community's idea of progress for them. How does the fear or suspicion towards otherness play into your understanding of heritage and tradition?
Mm-hmm. This might be more universal than some of the other things that I've said. Even here, living in Denver, Colorado, I feel, and certainly when I was in Pennsylvania, I felt the same thing. I think it's just ubiquitous. I think it's all over. I think you can't escape it, the way that we fear other people, fear of new colleagues who join this, you know, department or something. I mean, I think this sense of fear and mistrust, implicit mistrust, I think is pretty overpowering. And we currently live in an era where we're entertaining that question on a large scale politically. I think it continues to be a real question that we experience internally, quietly, And we're now, it's being broadcast, you know, on the minute in terms of the news and the larger world about who we trust and why and what seems to be safe and what seems not to be safe. It does seem like that's an important question, generally speaking.
I actually was thinking about this a little bit in terms of nostalgia. This happens all over the country. I think it happens especially in the Midwest. There is this tendency to idealize the past. Oh, even, yeah. I think the way that people perceive the Midwest, mm-hmm. the contemporary Midwest,
yeah.
sometimes those who live in it, those outside, have this idea that's sort of steeped in an earlier time. It's hard to see what is the contemporary Midwest. Yeah. Not that you can fully define that, but I think that could be difficult. And I think that the idealization tends to happen in the face of change and dissonance.
That's nice.
So I have a question for you, and I hope this won't feel like I'm taking your words and throwing them at you, because I don't mean to, but it was something that I read in an interview you did at Lighthouse, where you shared that your favorite place on earth is inside the memories of our kids when they were younger. And then you have this clarification, you love your kids more and more each and every day because you do. But, and I quote, when I slip into a time before, even if it was a week ago or yesterday, I'm absolutely in my favorite place on earth. To be here on earth with my amazing wife and these amazing kids, thinking of then, before, when the kids lived in a way that never, never fails to feel perfect. That might not be the ideal place to exist on earth necessarily, but it happens to be my favorite place on earth. And actually, that's very beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
I think that's a very beautiful thing to say. But it has that quality of nostalgia to it. And what was interesting to me when I came across that as your response, and not to diminish that beautiful sentiment, but when I look at the collection, so much of it is about a past that needs to be escaped or questioned or reckoned with. And I don't think these necessarily have to be contradictory things, but I was wondering if you could maybe parse out some of the seeming contradiction in them.
Yeah. No, I don't know that I can. I don't know that I think that's the conflict of those two things. I think I like that a lot. I'm pretty comfortable with not parsing it out, to be completely honest. I think that's the tension between those things, the sort of romanticizing of the past and the idealizing of another time and the way things were is, as you say, it's a beautiful sentiment. It's beautiful. And as I think I probably still agree with myself, that is probably the place I am most happy in doing so. It's also destructive and problematic. It fails to include, it fails to acknowledge the truth of the present moment. And I don't really desire to, I think there's a just, I have no desire to necessarily parse it out. I mean, it is just the sort of tension that I can't seem to escape. And it's easy for me to judge those who can't escape it. But I guess what you're calling out, and rightly so, is that I'm also perpetuating it or existing in it myself.
And
does
I don't,
that make sense?
Does it
that
does.
Sense?
No, it does make sense. And I don't want you to feel like you're called out. I can look back at specific moments in my life where I felt totally convinced that the year before that there was something about that was how could I not be in that anymore? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's even quite what you're saying, because you're enjoying memory almost in some ways.
Yes.
For me, it was idealizing. When I went to college, it was amazing at first. Yeah. And then something happened a few weeks in, just remember for a couple of weeks being like, why would I ever leave my home? Why am I here?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, like everything was good at my home. And it had a lot to do with the change and the dissonance of change in that moment for me.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to call you out on like, oh, you're being inconsistent, but just it was something that was interesting to me, because I felt like I could touch on that in a different way.
No, I like it. I like what you're saying a lot. Yeah, I love this idea of the dissonance of change. I mean, that sounds about right, too. And I feel the book in many ways marks this sort of dissonance of change for me. I think that makes sense. I had never really thought about it in that way. And you've done a beautiful job of articulating that.
Oh,
I'll go ahead and take that.
It's good that I'm here.
Yeah, thank God you've come. I don't know how I've been able to articulate. But I agree. I think that's a really good and a fair characterization of what was happening, is a sort of love of my family, at the same time a deep unsettled frustration with the fact that I couldn't move on, or that they haven't moved on, or all these different other realities of present day, and this frustration of that as well. And you can't shake certain things that you want to shake, and you can't live in the past in the way that you want to.
Well, we're sort of coming to the end of our time, so I just want to see if we can get a sneak peek at what you're working on now and where you're headed. Can you preview some projects?
Sure, I think so. I'm trying not to think about them too much as projects at all. I feel like I'm finally starting to move forward a bit. I continue to work on a novel that has been something I've been working on for a long time. That's not necessarily a new project, but it's one that I'm finally sitting down to sort of take seriously again. It's a similar dynamic, again, a story of the Midwest, and it's a story of escaping the Midwest and going back to one's roots in Scandinavia. It's a sort of inversion of the the sort of immigration story of so many Northern Europeans coming to America in the early 20th and 19th and late 19th centuries, the two waves of immigrants, and sort of an inversion of how Americans in the Midwest would transfer back to Northern Europe in that sort of way. So it's sort of playing with that idea, but that's one of the projects. And then I'm continuing to work on stories. Right now, my whole life is being an adjunct. Adjunct in one way or another, an adjunct faculty, an adjunct parent, an adjunct. I feel like every part of this word adjunct is just sort of the best description of how I feel as a general human. And so I'm playing with that with some smaller fictions right now.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading those. I'm looking forward to the novel as well. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and to share with us all things Scandinavian or Scan-American. Yeah. It's been quite illuminating.
Lindsay, thank you. That's really nice. Thank you.